Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Alien Crash Site. This week, we are teasing out some of the themes we've been discussing with other alien hunters in our community to learn a bit more about how size factors in our understanding of living systems. If you'd like a little more context for this conversation, I would recommend visiting past interviews with Nina Lanza, who is seeking signs of life on Mars, Michael Lachman, who talks origins of life in general, Cole Mathis, who speaks a bit about his work on assembly theory, and our last interview with Heather Graham, who worked on assembly theory as well, but also has a stoichiometric approach to life detection that she co-authored in a paper with this week's guest. This week, we bring Chris Kempes into the zone to think through alien existence and their potential technologies. And as it so happens, this episode airs on his birthday. Happy birthday, Chris. That was not my intention, but rather a lovely little display of serendipity in the universe. Chris is a professor here at the Santa Fe Institute. He is a mathematical biologist who works on scaling laws and is ultimately interested in where those scaling laws break down. What are their limits? What is the physiological constraint for life on Earth? How small can life be? How big? And how might that constraint change in other environments? He recently published a paper, along with David Krakauer, titled The Multiple Paths to Multiple Life, that attempts to reconfigure how we think about life forms and life origins events. We discuss this provocative proposal at length, along with the scaling research that I just described, before we shift to our venture into the zone to pursue a totally disgusting but definitely revelatory artifact, if we can even call it that. So with that, let's begin. My name is Caitlin McShay. This is the Santa Fe Institute's speculative podcast called Alien Crash Site. Zip up that spec suit, don those gloves, lace those boots, and please try to get everything out of your system before we embark on this treacherous journey. We will not be making any pit stops. Chris, welcome to Alien Crash Site. How are you doing?
I'm good. Caitlin, how are you? Good to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you too. You look like you're at work, which is lovely.
I am. Yeah, I'm at work in a workspace rather than my living room, which is nice.
Yeah. It's funny. I haven't seen you in that workspace on Zoom for like a year and a half. I'm used to seeing you in your home with your screen and the cat. It's great.
Yeah, different workspaces are nice.
So I have sort of a tall order for this podcast, and it's okay, I think, because great. You are really generous about exposition. But we just had Heather Graham on to talk about the paper that you and she and Simon Levin co-authored on stoichiometry. So I want to talk a little bit about that. And I want to move on to the multiple life paper, which is also a sort of provocative take on origins of life. And in order to do that, I think it would be good for our audience if you could give us a sort of scaling 101 so that we can learn why it is that size matters, so to speak, in our examination of the universe and where we might find life.
Great.
We'd be willing to take it away. That would be
fantastic. Yeah, happy to do that. Scaling is something that we all naturally think about more than we realize, right? So often we say, well, if I made that thing twice as big, what would happen, right? So people in very simple ways think about, well, if I made a house twice as many stories tall or wanted to make an automobile that was three times longer, what happens? And this is a very common thing to think about in engineering of what you have to change to make something much bigger. And in biology, you can then start to think about what changes with organism size. So as I go from a mouse to an elephant, what are all the things that change? Now, obviously, an elephant looks very different from a mouse in terms of it's got this long trunk and these big ears and sort of funny skin. And that's all interesting. But to me, what's sort of interesting about an elephant is how different the legs are compared to a mouse. So if you think about a mouse, they've got this kind of round body and these tiny little legs on them, tiny little skinny legs. Elephants have this round body and then these pretty sort of proportionally much larger, thicker legs. And there's reasons for that. There are physical reasons for that, which is basically to resist buckling. How much wider in diameter does a beam have to get to support an increasing amount of weight? And so you can think about as you scale up the volume of a mouse, what has to happen to the legs of an organism so that it doesn't buckle? And you get these weird elephant legs is the point. Now that happens for all sorts of features. And the idea is that it happens because of physics. So what's happening as organisms change size is that the way in which physics affects those organisms demands different evolutionary optima. Evolution has to find different solutions to deal with, say, the same physical forces at different sizes. And that leads to sort of non-proportional changes. And what I mean by that is you can't just take a mouse and make it 100 times bigger and keep everything the same. You have to start changing proportions and changing ratios of things in a non-proportional way. And that's really the essential idea of scaling. And so it's amazing for mammalian work, and this is work that was done here by Jeffrey West, Brian Inquist, and Jim Brown more than 20 years ago, is basically to say, well, if you look at metabolism, so how much energy an organism uses, as you go from mice to elephants, you see that as you increase body size linearly, you have to increase metabolism according to body size to the 3/4 power. So you get this power law change in metabolic rate. And it's not just a proportional change. So the exponent of that would be 1 if you just had a linear increase of metabolism with an increase in body size, but you have a less than linear increase in metabolism with body size. That was a puzzle for a long time. And the three people I mentioned a second ago worked out that if you think about fractal distribution networks and optimizing distribution of resources in a volume, like a mammalian body, you get this 3/4 power scaling law. Now we've taken that idea and applied it to microbial life. So thinking about bacteria and unicellular eukaryotes, which are more complex than bacteria, but less complex than a multicellular organism. And in all those organisms, we find scaling laws, which just tells you as you change the size of the organism, what changes. We find scaling laws for all sorts of different features. So for how much DNA an organism has, what's the total abundance of proteins in a cell as a function of cell size. All of these things have non-trivial, and what I mean by non-trivial is just non-proportional scaling relationships that often require fairly complex theories to predict why they scale the way that they do. And so we've gotten very excited about that because it tells us something about evolutionary history. It tells us something about the boundaries and possibilities of life. It tells us what life might look like elsewhere because a lot of these things are optimization in response to physical constraints. And those physical constraints don't change across the universe. So that might tell us something universal about life. It helps us do things like engineer new life and do all sorts of interesting new synthetic biology and bioengineering. And so we see these scaling relationships or scaling theories as foundational for a whole host of problems and applications in the biological sciences.
Okay, so that leads me to maybe a question, or if it's something that you're looking at, but when you think about something like the development from a very simple life form to something like a multicellular life form, do we think that multicellularity is the consequence of something like a scale limit? Like there's too much stuff in the thing, so now it has to be two things?
Absolutely, yeah, and you nailed it. So what's cool is that once you have a scaling law in an organism and you say, okay, I actually understand the dominant physics driving the scaling relationship, then you also expect those to break down at some point, right? So you expect there to be sort of a critical scale where things become infinitely hard or where some essential process goes to zero. And that's because the constraints associated with certain physical laws really depend a lot on scale. You know, at some point, diffusion becomes so slow that you can't rely on it anymore. And you have to start pumping, you have to start moving things around actively, or you won't be able to keep the cell's metabolic rate going from diffusion alone. A lot of these things then tell us that there are critical scales. And so what you often have to do at one of those critical scales is radically shift architecture. In some of our work, we've been able to show that at the upper end of bacteria, you run into all of these infinite challenges. You need more of something than you can physically fit in your cell because things are going too fast for the case of bacteria. And so what do? You have this radical change in architecture. That's a unicellular eukaryote, which is basically just something like a bacterium packed inside something else like a bacterium. So it's sort of the same architecture, but now packed within itself to give you these two layers of hierarchy. And then that's a different architecture. We know that there's a scale where the unicellular eukaryotes run into all sorts of problems, and you have to have a different architectural shift. And that's where you go to multicellularity. And at the bottom end of bacteria, like at the very smallest end of life, you run into all of these other challenges and you don't see cells below a certain limit. You do see viruses that are much smaller, but viruses are yet another architectural shift, right? And so we really do think that a lot of understanding the major transitions in evolution is about understanding where there are these scale limits, as you put it.
Oh, that's really helpful. My introduction to scaling, more or less, when I first came to SFI, was how you found a lot of generalities across biology that seem also to be applied beyond what we would consider biology. And so a lot of work on cities and economies. I kind of like entered scaling through that perspective, but now I'm thinking a lot more about life these days. And so it's really good to have that sort of life introduction, since it's essentially a life thing. Scaling like was life first, so to speak. So that's really helpful.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because for me, cities are another evolutionary transition. I like to think of cities as a biological system, but just one that's undergone a really radical evolutionary transition from other organisms. And so I think the transitions we're talking about there are one to sort of living in groups and being social. And so social insects are an interesting sort of evolutionary transition. And then humans do this extra thing where we start accumulating information and knowledge and using that to build new technologies. And then we get these like crazy things like cities that I think are yet another evolutionary transition, but really should be seen in light of that sort of overall biological trajectory. Yeah.
And in terms of the example that you gave of architecture, the city kind of falls right in line with that, because as we get into a small pocket that has like a growing population, you have to start building upward in order to fit everything. And that's why cities look like cities. It's an architectural shift as a cause of a limit of scale.
Exactly. Yeah. And then at some point, you have people who want to live on one side of a city and work on the other. And so then you have to build transportation systems, and all of those are interesting architectural additions, right?
Right. And they seem to follow this sort of three-quarter power law scaling. Maybe too much to bring that in. It's funny. So I wanted to ask you about scaling because I wanted to see how it applies mathematically to the stoichiometry paper. But now that we're talking about cities, it seems like a more natural transition to move right along to multiple life.
Perfect. Yeah.
If that's okay. All right. That's so fine. You and David recently published a piece where you propose, as you just used the city for an example, that there are, along the whole kind of trajectory of life's process, other forms of life have emerged. And it would be beneficial to the field of origins of life research to consider those things like complex life, multicellularity, or culture, or city, et cetera, as a life form. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why that's helpful in terms of like a principles first method of life detection.
Yeah, so I think it's sort of interesting. In that paper, we sort of trace out what we think has happened in biology, which is, you know, initially biology was all about an extant centric perspective, as we call it, which is you look around, you see all this amazing diversity, you see all these organisms doing all these very unique and interesting things, and you try to understand that diversity, right? Just the things around you. And then later, you know, following Darwin, following different things that happened in the molecular revolutions in biology, we then start to realize there's this interesting tree. You know, there's this amazing history of sort of branching and lineages and things that have common ancestors that now look very similar, look very different. And so then perspectives on life became very sort of history centric and trying to understand that whole tree. And now we think what we want to do is move into sort of a principles first perspective, because we might have very different trees elsewhere. A theory of life, if you had one, should be in some sense agnostic to history. It should sort of not care too much about the details of how something got started, or even the details of the materials that life happens to use. It should care more about what it is that life is doing, right? What principles does life have? What are the essential processes and principles to really nail down to understand that something's living? In that perspective, we say, well, from a certain lens of certain theories, it's not so different to talk about culture as a life form living on the very bizarre material of human beings, very advanced material of human beings, compared to some other evolutionary process. And what we mean by that is if you wrote down certain equations for how what the evolutionary process looked like, the cultural evolutionary process might look very similar to certain biological evolutionary processes. And so then in some sense, culture has some amount of livingness with it associated with this sort of evolutionary dynamic. Now, culture might be less living than a bacteria. We're not sure. We think that we need to come up with sort of very high dimensional, continuous metrics for what life actually is. But our point is that even in things that people would call biological, you get into some very strange knots already about what would be living and what would not be, unless you go to this sort of principles first perspective. And so, for example, most organisms in the current biosphere have some sort of obligate symbiosis with something else, right? There's some sort of dependence on another organism. As an example, unicellular eukaryote cells we were talking about, or even us, require mitochondria inside those cells. And that comes out of a, you know, a deep symbiosis. So that's sort of one life requiring a lower level of life to exist. We require cells to exist. And even certain autotrophs, certain things that produce their energy just directly from a source like the sun or from a chemical environment, a lot of those autotrophs actually have been found to require sort of symbiotic relationships with other organisms. And so from that perspective, we really thinking about life as a principle of what the thing does. And then there's a separate question about how complicated an environment it requires. So a virus to us is life. It's just life that requires a very complicated environment, a very complex and rich environment, that of an entire other cell. But from a process perspective or a principle perspective, viruses and humans aren't necessarily that different in our perspective, because it's just requiring different layers of hierarchy, right? So viruses use things more complex than them to replicate. We integrate less complex things to replicate our overall genome and make another human. But it's really just sort of different types of connections of hierarchy. And from certain principle perspectives, viruses and humans don't look so different. From other principle perspectives, they're very different, right? Like if you added intelligence to the mix, right? Or you added certain measures of individuality to the mix, you can certainly distinguish viruses and humans. But just for some metrics, for some evolutionary metrics or some metrics of dependence, the two might not actually look that different. Those are the points we wanted to make. Yeah.
That's great. I have like three things that I want to talk about. Two are maybe challenges, and one is just about this idea of intelligence in our consideration of aliveness. Yeah. Because the thing about the virus is that the virus does very lifey things. It literally replicates itself into the future over and over again and very well, but it can't do it alone, right? This is the symbiont right. thing that you're talking about. But to me, it seems like to have exploited the mechanism of another cell and to like so simplify yourself and outsource the work, that to me seems like a form of intelligence. And then things get tricky. I almost like the virus better than the cell, but I don't know. It's interesting to me when intelligence gets in the mix. And of course, everything gets muddy, and that's the case. So I wanted to say that, but then I wanted to go, okay, so I have two big questions about the multiple life paper. And one is about origins themselves and one is about death, both in relationship to this example of culture. How can I frame this? I guess I'll start with the origin first. I am all in favor of the consideration of culture as a living thing. I agree with the proposal that to consider how these things behave once they emerge, very lifelike, and that's helpful in sort of kind of broadening our perspective of what to look for from a principles first perspective. I think that's good. But I wonder, once it emerges, it behaves like life, but I'm not sure that it emerges in the same way that life does. And I don't know whether or not to suggest that technology and culture, et cetera, have their own origin is helpful or harmful to the field, so to speak. And this isn't a criticism that you're unaware of. You include Sarah's Andromeda strain thing in the paper, but if we equate an origins event across all of these things and life, that almost seems like a step away from agnosticism to me.
That's interesting. So I think there are a couple of points there. So I think you're totally right. There may be very different types of origins. Now, from a certain abstract perspective, the way that language might have started to evolve, where you start off with fairly simple information exchanges, and then you realize like, oh, there's a lot of utility to this. Like we can avoid predators. We can, I can tell you how far something away is, so we can plan whether we all want to go there together. You know, like information exchange starts to have a lot of meaning. And then you can imagine how that just starts to get more complex in time, which is sort of what life is doing at the beginning. You come across certain features that allow you to replicate more into the future. And then the question is how that bootstrapping starts to give you more and more complexity. So language might be the same sort of thing. Now, certain aspects of technology, I agree, might be a totally different type of origin, right? Because it's actually, some of these things are being produced by planners. This is one of the things that humans do that is very different. There's a lot of sort of evolutionary trial and error in our design of things, but there's also a lot of intentionality, which is very different, right? Yes. So when we build a rocket to go to the moon, there's a huge amount of trial and error in the development of rockets, right? But there was also a lot of using principles, writing down mathematics, making calculations, being able to forecast the way that something would work, having not tried it, and in a lot of cases being right, a lot of cases being wrong. But it's not like we sort of created a random rocket generator, right? Of just every possible design. And then you just fire those off. And then you pick the 20 designs of those that got closest to the moon. And you allow all of those to mate and have offspring. And then the next generation to fire towards the moon, you take the 10 best of that. You could actually do evolutionary rocket design. It's very expensive. And it wouldn't be as fast as the way that we designed rockets. So I agree that there's a certain sort of directionality to technology that's very different, a different sort of origin. Now, the point about the fact that culture is coming out, ultimately, like ultimate causality of culture is an origin of life on Earth.
Right.
And I think that's your point. Like there is an ultimate causality there, but then like that ultimate causality may go back even further to the formation of Earth and its particular elemental composition and all sorts of things. I think our point is more, if you know nothing about history, which you may not always get, because evolution sometimes may erase its history because of certain dynamics, and you just are given a current object or dynamic or thing, can you describe how living it is? And in some sense, that's what we want to be able to do, is to say, I may not always be able to view history, but if you show me a process or a thing, I want to tell you how living I think it is, without necessarily knowing a detailed history.
I guess what I was suggesting is that if we say that culture is a living thing, and I'm totally for that, and Atlantis just wrote a little dispatch about it, actually, about this paper.
Right.
That's, I think, helpful to the field. But I think if we were to say culture emerges from culturelessness in a similar way that life emerges from lifelessness, that seemed like a bridge too far. But that's not what you're suggesting in the paper.
Right. Okay. Exactly. Yeah. And I think, I mean, and also the life emerged from lifelessness is also tricky too, because I would say that there's a spectrum that goes all the way back there too, where like some initial chemical dynamic might have had a tiny bit of livingness to it, right? That also is a complicated issue to grapple with. Yeah.
No, that's exactly right. So, I mean, if like some cognitive cultural scientist found last universal cultural artifact and determined the mechanism by which it came about, that would not be maybe a good thing for us, because it would be like, wow, maybe this is what we should look for life like through this lens, but it's so very different. Okay.
I think the other thing to emphasize here too is we think part of the strangeness of things like culture or other types of human inventions is that you can have transitions from the living into the non-living and then back into the living. So we would say humans making calculators are like something humans have. It's a tool, right? We would say that is part of like a cultural evolutionary process, but as a thing, that calculator doesn't have much livingness to it, right? But then as we produce calculators to be more complicated, and then suddenly we start to simulate artificial life on those computers, and then we make those simulations bigger, all of a sudden you could get a transition back into something that's really living, right? And so there we would say, sure, that's all like causally connected to humans, but if you were tracking that part of the tree, it would look very different than a long lineage of bacteria where it has to maintain its livingness at every step. Some of these substrates would transition out of the living and then back into the living, which is, we think, really interesting.
And it is interesting, aside from the example of multicellularity, which we've discussed, so many of these other life forms that you and David identify, as you say, exist upon the material of human life. So there is something kind of special about humanity, which, I mean, that's, I love, I think that humanity is quite interesting. And it's funny that these things that we recognize as life forms are a condition of our existence anyway. Speaking of cult, this is my second question on death. We think about aging and death a lot at SFI, as you know, you're part of that research as well. And it seems to me that, you know, maybe culture doesn't die, but language has died, right? We say that Latin is a dead language, even though we're still using it for botany and we're learning it in high school. I don't know how dead it is, but like culture gets to continue in a way that seems different to me than life. And I wonder, you know, now that we are looking at them both as lifey, how important is death to this research? What does death signify to us?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I think you could get cases where lineages died, right? So I think there's that sort of analogy where you sort of are like, oh, there's this whole lineage that we see in the fossil record that we don't have living descendants from. You have to go back to an earlier common ancestor to find those descendants. So that's an interesting parallel. I think for a language, for example, to truly die, we need to not know about it, right? That's kind of one of the principles we would get to here, is there's something about information, utility, preservation, interpretability that keeps something alive. For example, if we found a fossil genome, but we had no way to boot it, we don't know what chemical environment to drop this genome into so that it'll start replicating itself, then in some sense, we know the thing existed, but it's dead from an evolutionary trajectory perspective, right? There's no way to propagate it into the future or to allow it to have utility from the information it was storing. And it might also be true for dead languages, right? If you found a language where you find pages and pages of a language, but there's really no way to translate it or interpret the information, then it's lost most of its livingness or ability to evolve or ability to have to influence the world in all the ways that life would too. I think that is where death starts to matter. It's almost when you can't define the principles of life any more than something is dead. And okay. Then there's a slight difference in that for some things you can tell that they were living in the past because they still hold a lot of information. They just have lost most of their livingness because they can't do anything with that information. I guess what I mean is like a skeleton of a dinosaur. We can learn a lot about evolutionary history from that, what its lifestyle was like. We can interpret that information. That information just doesn't have utility to that lineage forward propagation in the same way that there's information in a geological sedimentation. Like we can tell like, oh, a volcano erupted, and then there was this period of not much volcanic activity, and then another huge volcano erupt. Like we can read out the information from that because we have models about the information, but that information doesn't have any consequence on the system that's sort of propagating it or interacting with it. And so it's dead in some sense. Yeah. Or in a lot of senses.
Right. And so, as you say, we can interpret like a lifestyle for these dinosaurs based on the technology that we have in the fossil record, like the actual example in front of us. Right. Maybe this can help us transition into some questions about life detection in the universe. Sure, so yeah. when we're thinking about the rock samples that Perseverance is collecting, or the, you know, Dragonfly missions here and there to kind of oceany, icy planetary bodies. Right. Like how can we interpret what we see when it's so unlike our own with what little we know about life's origins itself, even here?
Right.
We don't even know ours.
Yeah, agreed. I think it's a very hard problem, which is why it's so fun. And, you know, I think, you know, going back to this multiple life paper that we had, we would say this is one of the reasons you want to transition away from a focus on materials to a focus on principles. The materials that life uses might be quite diverse, even if the principles are the same. A simple way to think about that is you can implement a certain type of optimization using many different types of software, each running on many different types of hardware as a computational analogy. So the thing that's constant in all of that is the type of optimization you're doing. Different algorithms or software for doing that, much more diverse. Hardware that you can implement that on, really diverse, right? So at some level, then we would say the material bit may be the most flexible. Where there's likely to be lots of convergence in life is at the principles level. And that's part of the reason we wanted to say sort of you have other unique origins of life is to say that even in really radical materials like humans, you get these sort of convergent evolution of entities and processes that find the same sorts of principles. So when we're looking for life elsewhere, I think that's really essential is to start identifying the types of principles we're looking for rather than the types of materials. And so a simple example of that would be, okay, everything on life shares roughly the same use of DNA. That's fantastic. Really gives us a huge target for looking for life on Earth.
On Earth.
And even then we might miss something. I think that's probably low probability, but it's certainly a possibility. DNA elsewhere, but what's DNA really doing? It's storing information. Right. It's finding a way to go from information to function. So it's really storing information about functions and then being replicated along with all those functions to do the same sort of thing.
Right. It's like a material memory.
It's material memory of things that are useful in the environment.
Okay.
There's lots of ways to do that. Our computers, for example, store information that we then turn into functions or functional utility in lots of different ways. And so then you realize, well, there's nothing special about DNA. I mean, there are some things that are chemically special and interesting about it, but from that concept of storing information, there could be lots of ways to do that, even chemically. So then what are we looking for? Well, we're really looking for something that stores information with high fidelity and can propagate it into the next generation. and which can map that information to functions, right? So how do you look for that? And so that would be like one sort of target that you're after, is that sort of information storage and propagation. But lots of molecules could do that, right? So then we need to think about that more abstractly. We need to have kind of a principles first perspective on that so that we don't design technologies to target asking if an environment has DNA. We target technologies to ask, does an environment have really interesting information storage?
An environment.
Yeah, I mean, within an environment. So I mean, like if you put a probe in a bit of water, there's subsystems in this that are storing information in interesting ways.
So this is, I guess, a challenge, and it's the challenge, but I want to see how you feel about it. Obviously, what we're saying or claiming to do, because if life is happening all over the universe, and obviously we wouldn't pursue it if we didn't think that that was a possibility.
Yep.
The fact of the matter is that life happens along very large and diverse timescales. And so what would be the most amazing thing is if we observed extant life elsewhere, we could see that things, that memories were being used for future functionality. We could see the information in use, but we haven't seen that yet. And so what we're really doing a lot of the time is looking for signs of past life. And I just wonder how we can be sure that this thing that we discover is something like DNA if we don't observe it functionally.
You know, DNA would have some other clues to it, as would all the functional proteins in the cell, right? I mean, one is that they're very long molecules.
Right.
That are these strings of things that have been put together. Some of that would be fairly improbable to do in a rich chemical environment. And this gets into some of the stuff that Heather talked about with chemical complexity and lots of different perspectives on that. And so I think there are ways to think about that. A lot of the work we've done on the stoichiometric side is just to say, imagine we just take the bulk properties of a cell. So we mix up all the DNA and proteins and we just ask what elemental signatures do we have. Then we often find these really systematic patterns in the ratio of elements, ratio of atoms across particles of different size in bacteria. We think we can abstract that to a level where that might be a target, where you're just looking for certain sorts of patterns in how the chemistry is shifting across scales, for example, in terms of like how heterogeneous the small scales are as you scan across the small microenvironment. Those are ways to get at some of that.
Yeah.
We've generalized extant life to produce some of those things. We don't have something like a mathematical proof yet for any of these things that says like, you know, here is the definitive yes, no, right? So there's still a huge amount of theoretical work to be done in all of these different dimensions to really figure out where precise yes, no cutoffs are for detecting life, or even just how far along a spectrum you are. Yeah.
Can you, I know that our listeners heard Heather sort of describe it. What's interesting about the stoichiometric approach is that you can scan the environment of a very strange non-Earth-like planetary body, and you can see how the chemicals are sort of distributed across them. And then you might come upon an area where for some reason there's this anomalous distribution of those elements. And that seems to be an indicator of something lifelike doing weird things.
Right.
Yeah. Can you sort of more clearly articulate that summary, how it is that we would detect that?
The one you described is great. The sort of out of equilibrium perspective, which would be, you know, if you think about the diversity and density of chemicals in a cell, it's quite different than lots of minerals or other microenvironments. And so if you came across this cell, you'd be like, wow, suddenly there's like this huge amount of diversity and so forth. But even if you couldn't resolve things at that scale, you can still start to play games where you say, okay, in modern ecology, cells have a very regular distribution of sizes. And we understand from this scaling theory and from some ecological models why those distributions are what they are. Now suddenly you can say, okay, actually I might be looking for a particular distribution of particle sizes. And if I find that distribution, the other thing we know is that the physiology of the small particles, say small bacteria from large bacteria, changes in really systematic ways. So small bacteria are mostly DNA and proteins packed tightly in this little membrane. And then as you get bigger, both the DNA and the proteins dilute out, and other components of the cell like ribosomes increase in relative abundance to both of those. And all of that comes with stoichiometric shifts. And so then we're able to write down a theory that says, as you go across particle size, you should see systematically changing ratios of one element to another. And so we think that's an exciting biosignature. We're doing a lot of work to test that against purely abiotic systems to make sure that you can't be fooled. And we're thinking through some of the physics there too. But we think that now that gives you a simple target where you say, if I can just sort out the particles from a fluid and I can measure what their size distribution is, and I can measure how stoichiometry shifts across that size distribution, suddenly I might have a dead giveaway that there's life, even if it has really different physiology than the one we know. That's sort of exciting.
Yeah, definitely. Kind of a broad general question. In your opinion, does life require a container?
I think life requires separation at some level. And the reason I say that is mostly, if you think about early life as some sort of simple cooperation, but then there's some sort of simple cheaters and so forth, we know from other parts of ecology that a really good way to allow cooperators to exist is to have spatial separation.
Okay.
That can be spatial separation along a 2D plane, that can be separation into cavities or other sorts of things. So I think at some level, you do start to need separation, and that starts to have effects on cooperation, selection, what thing you're actually selecting. I mean, one thing that separation gives you a lot of is the ability to have much stronger selection mm-hmm. systems, which will speed up evolution and so forth. Separation is important. Yeah. Separation also allows you to get lots of instances of similar things that have some amount of variation, and that's good for selection as well. But that can also be just lots of individual microenvironments. The thing about encapsulation is so cool is that you can have all these microdynamics that are getting mixed together in an environment, but the microdynamics are preserved.
Right.
And then you get selection. And then if you have replication on top of that, that really helps. That goes a long way. But one could contrive 2D planes that have the right sort of dynamic and so forth.
Thank you for taking that on. It's a divisive question, I think, but that's okay. So I want to be conscious of our time, and I want to be sure that as we're talking about aliens, we get to the artifact. So I've got one more question, then we'll switch to the alien artifact question, because I'm curious to see what you would hope to discover. Given everything that we've discussed and given what you know of the knowable bits of the universe, where's the first place you would go in search of life? Where are you most interested in going?
That's a very hard question for me. It's funny, I'm very much of the mind of look everywhere. The reason for that is because I just don't know how hard the beginning is. I sort of 3 days a week think the beginning is really easy, and 3 days a week I think the beginning is really hard, and then I take 1 day a week not to think about it. I vacillate on that a huge amount. So if it's really hard, then I think we should look everywhere because we're waiting for the probabilities. If it's super easy, then we should look everywhere just to get a sense of the diversity. I'm excited about exoplanets. I'm excited about ocean worlds. You know, I'm excited about Mars. And so I think all of these things are good places to look. And I think, you know, here we've also gotten quite surprised our own planet about where life is, right?
Yeah.
You know, the fact that we can't observe with a telescope an extant forest on another planet makes the problem harder, right? If there's a forest, this whole field wouldn't have existed, and then it would all just be about sort of comparative biology. And once you have, you know, then I think principles come out of that, because like as soon as you find a different information storage molecule in another instance of life, then it immediately forces you to ask the question about like, okay, what are all the different ways to do something? What are the principles we're really after? But since we don't have an obvious, oh, we know it's there, we just want to go find out what it's like in terms of, you know, there's like this green mat over some surface, it's harder for us in our solar system to pick places. So I'm very much of the go everywhere mind.
The good hedging of the question, but you've rationalized it well. So I think that's fine. Just an N of two would give us even one commonality would be huge, again, in terms of principles and processes.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but right now we find ourselves on the planet Earth, and recently in our lives, an alien life form came to us as opposed to us sending probes out looking for them. And in their wake, they left behind a variety of objects in very dangerous places in their alien crash sites, in their zones. So Chris, at the risk of imprisonment, great personal injury, even death, what object do you hope to recover from an alien crash site?
I think this is such a great question. I've been thinking about it a lot since this podcast started. And I think the original idea of the sci-fi story is just, it's so insightful because you start to realize how important trash is. In astrobiology, we think a lot about waste in general, and I'll come back to that. I was realizing like there's so many pieces of trash that if we took back in time to different parts in human civilization would be just mind-bending. aluminum foil, which we throw away all the time, is unbelievable. It's amazingly light. It's thin. It's strong for how thin it is. It's really flexible. You can reuse it. That would really amaze people at different eras in history. And the same is true for our textiles. I'm not sure an iPhone would impress people in the past as much as our textiles would. You think of the most high performance synthetic fabric that we have, soft, smooth, light, durable, flexible, strong, warm, water repellent it is, would just be amazing to people, right? I think if you showed certain people in certain parts of history an iPhone, they would sort of think it's magic. But if you showed a textile, it would be amazing. So that's just to say, I think the trash perspective is really a clever idea for this whole sci-fi story, because there is so much information in trash and amazement in trash. Now, I sort of have a funny or a kind of boring answer about an artifact, maybe not boring. I want a corporal sample. So I want, you know, this is going to sound very alien autopsy, which is, you know, not really my perspective on the world, but I want to look at a bit of the alien bodies, right?
That's cheating.
It is cheating. So here's how I get around the cheating. I would be happy with sewage. Right.
Okay, all right.
If there was sewage left behind that had the equivalent of toenails in it or cell detritus or whatever it was, right? It's awful. It's disgusting to think about. But I really want to look at chemistry and the macromolecules and what's being used. I also would be interested to know if it's totally not organic or liquid chemical in the way that we think. To me, a big puzzlement of if aliens had landed here is, that's a huge challenge energetically, right? Like the challenge of getting between the stars is a huge energetic problem. You either need to spend a long time in a closed ecosystem, which could, by the way, just be if you're fully AI and you live in a digital world, that's an easy way to have a closed ecosystem. Or you need to be very small, which might also be digitization or some sort of synthetic next evolutionary step. And so those are the sort of things I want to know. I either want to know if it's wet chemical like us, I kind of want to see the cell samples of the refuse to know something about the history, to sort of uncover something about how different that is. And if it's fully digital life, I want to know that because I want to know that that is what an evolutionary trajectory converged on. And those aren't really artifacts, but they are trash.
Okay, that's fine. Trash is a good way, but yeah, here's the thing. And this might be, maybe you forget the very beginning, but my one and only rule is that you can't have a biological specimen. It's my only rule. But
if you,
okay, so
yeah, so if you allow, I forgot this rule. I'm very sorry, but I if you count sewage or a pit stop as possible, then that, you know, that would.
No, I think that's a good workaround. You said something like sewage that contains within it fingernails. No, that's not good. That breaks the rules. I don't know. Is urine dead enough and empty enough to like be a clue without being a biological specimen?
No,
like
you could still filter some cells out of it.
That's, yeah, exactly. So what's the minimum, right? Like if the digital thing gets around it, but can we imagine what the like minimum unit of from life without containing life would be as a clue to this?
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think, so for me, it's also this thing about if you had a species that travels between the stars, which is very hard to do, how much waste do you actually leave? Because it might be, you know, sort of a fully recycling sort of thing. But if they accidentally dropped an artifact, what is that artifact for me? That would tell you there's life without actually containing a sample.
Or what can we glean from something like that? Like we say it does require a lot of energy. And given the sophisticated nature of these aliens, we have to be pretty certain that they're not in our solar system, because otherwise we would have found them, I think, by now.
Right.
So they come from a very far place. It requires a lot of energy to get here and then to leave again. And that could almost be a proxy for like the types of things that this life form metabolizes.
Right.
Is there a way that we can think about that in terms of our own human experience? Yeah. Does the type of energy that we use, whether extracted from the earth or like from the sun, does that have any reflection about the type of thing that we are? Does that reflect in any way on the type of energy that we...
I mean, I think at that point, I would then probably take any bit of the hull that had broken off. I think you would learn a lot from understanding what the material construction processes look like, and then also what the materials are designed for. Is it all about electromagnetic shielding, or is it all about thermal? Is it all about insulation? So I guess what I mean is that humans have a very specific temperature requirement. So we have a very clear optimal temperature. I actually think that's bound to be true for most wet life, let's call it. So most life in solution, I think, is likely to have an optimum temperature for each species. evolution can change that in time, but it's likely to have an optimal temperature. And so then you care a lot about thermoregulation in a spacecraft. And so I'd be interested in knowing if it looks from a, say, a big fragment of the hull, if it looks like insulation is being done, because computers, you know, we're much better at getting computers to work at lots of different temperatures. I mean, there's still temperature regimes there that matter, but it's much less precise than like the temperatures a human being can be kept at. Computations produce heat.
Right, right.
But then if it's all about electromagnetic shielding, it's very clear that like the hull is designed to really very precisely shield certain sorts of electromagnetic stuff, then you could start to make inferences about maybe this being a post-wet life form, circuits running AI sort of thing.
Right.
I would take a bit of the hull just to know. Now, that's not a cool artifact that does anything, but I want to know what they're like.
But I don't think that it's not necessarily a cool artifact, right? What happens in the book is that these stalkers or these scientists retrieve these things. And even if they necessarily misinfer or misinterpret what the purpose for the aliens are, they right. find novel applications. So if you found a bit of this hull and it happens to, as you say, do a lot of shielding electromagnetically, you could infer that this was a post-wet life form, as you called it, but we could also like build all of our cars out of it and do like right. interesting new things with it. And that would be revolutionary.
Well, and I'm guessing it's probably, we're on the cusp of doing a lot of really interesting nanomaterial work and already are doing that, right?
Yeah.
And so seeing how far that technology goes with a civilization would be very interesting to me also.
A ship piece is nice because it touches on the waste aspect of the premise of the novel itself, but it does inform us or inform someone like you a little bit, just a clue as to, well, we know that the life exists because it happened. Nobody in the book talks about, nobody saw anything, which is kind of strange. It's so weird that we don't get to witness the actual visitation. It seems that if we take the material that we find and even get even a half of an inference from it, that is a bit of information that would allow us to draw, for instance, a commonality between whatever this N of two is and ourselves, hopefully, in its right. application. Sorry that you can't have like a fecal sample.
Well, I mean, the other thing is if it's circuits running algorithms is like the evolutionary transition that's happened, then you also don't get wet waste from that either. So that's, it could be an unlikely thing to see, right?
What is like an example of a waste product from, for instance, a life or like our technology, right? Is it just like a chip? Is it a bunch of copper?
Yeah. If some part of the ship had sort of broken or fallen off and it was the part that was actually part of a corpal sample, but in a non-wet way, right? You would be looking for transistor-like things, I think, yeah. right? I think you'd be looking for, and again, this might be overtuned on the way that we've built computers, but you would be looking for sort of something that's doing connected gate processing, right? And you would be looking for sort of extreme miniaturization and lots of structure in that miniaturization. But then again, who knows what computers we build in 1,000 years.
Right. And who knows what computers these sophisticated aliens are building that are probably way, way, way more advanced than ours.
Right.
Yeah. It might just be so hyper miniaturized that our technology wouldn't allow us to see the actual structure of the item itself. And then we're blind to it. And we're like, wow, this isn't so sophisticated after all, because we're not sophisticated. So that's good. All right. Okay. I'll allow it because it's not a wet sample.
Great. Yeah. So you'll allow me to take detritus from non-wet life. Yeah,
yes.
that's great. Yeah,
that's good. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
This is great. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much, Caitlin. Yeah.
Yeah. No, this is great. I really, really like the way that you're approaching this sort of work, and I like that you're willing to have a little bit of fun because it's. I think that the fun also clarifies like how little we know and how much there is to speculate. And sometimes speculation is important when we're designing technology that will eventually hunt aliens down and bring them back here, hopefully nicely. Who knows? Yeah,
exactly that. Yeah, that's a whole that's a whole other podcast.
A whole other podcast, exactly. Well, thank you for stepping into the zone. You are safely out of it, and I will see you at Cowan in like an hour.
Great, see you in an hour. Yeah, see you at lunch here soon. And yeah, thanks again. Okay,
yeah, bye Chris, thank you.